KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and this is Radio Orbit. Stick around. We've got a conversation with Jonathan Zapp and the music of Charles Shea. There you have it, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Mike, and it's Radio Orbit, just a few minutes after 11 p.m. on the 29th of January, almost into February now, in 2007. Time just flying by as it does. And it's good to be with you all tonight. Thanks for listening to the program. Quick thank you to Debbie Johnson, as always, Free Range Radio Theater, great stuff. On the air from 10 p.m. until 11 every Monday. Just before this program, before Debbie, Kelvin, and Jason doing it up, jazz plus blues equals frozen solid. Tech radio, always informative. Jeff Wheeler starting things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Great radio on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be a part of it. Okay, thanks to everybody who listened to the program last week and participated. Thanks, of course, to Michael and Star. That's Star Newland and Dr. Michael Heisen from the Sirius Institute in Pune, Hawaii, doing great work in all kinds of different areas. Wow, yeah, great stuff. Hope you heard it. We were also supposed to hear the music of Void's Anatomy, but I had some technical difficulties with the MP3 player last week, so we'll bring that back in the future for a fitting show. My apologies to Marie, but we'll get it together in the future, okay? If you missed that show, it's all on the web, www.mikehagan.com. Just go to the program archives, and you can download, listen, share, whatever you will, all right? Okay, tonight, Jonathan Zapp. John was on the program on October 9th, I think it was, of last year, 2006. I'm glad to welcome him back tonight. We'll talk about oracles, the I Ching in particular. He and I have both had some sort of synchronistic things happen over the last couple weeks, and we were talking about it off the air the other day, and we decided we'd talk about the I Ching. For those unfamiliar, you'll learn about it in just a little while here. But it's an ancient Chinese oracle, I guess, of sorts, a divination tool. But we'll talk about the I Ching in particular. We'll also talk about Zap Oracle. Jonathan has sort of his own visionary oracle that we'll learn about. And, I don't know. 2012 probably we'll talk about, maybe some Jungian psychology. So we'll see. But anyway, Jonathan Zapp, wonderful stuff from Jonathan always. And he can talk about a whole lot of different topics. So stick around for that in just about 45 minutes, okay? Jonathan Zapp, you can check him out, by the way, on the web at ZapOracle, ZapOracle.com, ZapOracle.com. And I also have some music lined up for tonight. Charles Shea and music and songs from his CD called Creation. We started things off appropriately there with The Big Bang. And we'll have more from Charles throughout the program tonight. You can find info about the music that we play on the program on the web as well at my site in the music archives. Just go over to MikeHagan.com again and just click through and find the music archives, all right? Okay, great stuff coming up, so stick in tune with me, all right? Okay, hello to everybody. Thanks for listening. If you're listening on the traditional airwaves here via KOPN 89.5 FM here in Mid-Missouri, I welcome you to the program. Thanks for listening, as always. And if you're listening over the web, live or otherwise, via Cosmic Waves Radio is the way we do it live over the web, but you can also listen to the archives ex post facto, as it were. So, you know, when I do the show, I try to do it in such a fashion that it really doesn't matter if you're listening to it live or if you hear it after the fact. So to the people that are listening to it after the fact, hello to you as well. And hopefully you hear the program not too long after it was actually originally broadcast, and it's not too dated, if you know what I mean. But I think back about that for a second. I think about listening to the old program, so too, you know, with a little bit of hindsight. And that's pretty interesting, too, sometimes, because you hear, sometimes you go, wow, that guy was totally FOS, including me. Or, you know, that person or guest was right on target, you know, and you can look back at it and listen and see what how things sort of panned out, you know. Anyway, as I said, on the web, cosmicwavesradio.com, you can listen to the program live every week, streamed via the great people over there. And thank you to everybody who makes it happen, both at KOPN and at Cosmic Waves. I appreciate it to both organizations for giving us the opportunity to get our voices out there, you know. All right, also thanks to Larry, the web wizard, as always. My thoughts to you, brother, tonight. I wish the best for you and your family, okay? Everybody else out there sending art, music, poetry. Awesome. I love it. Send more, 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 more. And again, hats off to Larry for putting it all together on the web, okay? Check it out and let me know what you think about it. As I said, one more time, I'll not repeat it too many times tonight, but it's Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. And if you go over there, you'll have access to everything we're doing. And if you take a look and see, you can share your thoughts with us and let us know what we're doing. Try to do things better if you give us some sort of, you know, constructive criticism. And there's lots going on. We have a bulletin board / forum that's always busy and lots of interesting topics being discussed over there all the time. I can't keep up with it anymore, there are lots of people there that are posting interesting and provocative stories and topics every day. There's a live chat room that's up and active every week, as it is right now. I'll have to peek in there here in a few minutes. And you're welcome to join us there if you're listening to the program on the web or otherwise. And, you know, it's a great place to post questions and comments and anything like that. I encourage the guests as well as the listeners to join us in the chat and in the forum. And, you know, I was thinking the other day about what happened was I got an email from a recent guest. I won't say who it was, but I got a real personal email, a really nice one. And she mentioned how many, it wasn't a lot, but she got three or four really nice emails from people who had heard the program. And I can't tell you how much it means to the guests to hear from listeners. And, you know, I'd like to encourage you guys and girls out there, if you hear the program and you like one of the guests, feel free to, you know, go over to their website. Most of them are pretty accessible. And send them a quick note or send it through me. I'd be glad to forward anything like that, you know, because it means a lot to the people that are on the program to hear that people actually appreciate what they're talking about and got something out of the conversation that I have with them. So, you know, they all know that I like them, because I'm the one that invites them on the program, and And I'm not sort of typical in that sense where I don't invite people that I don't like. You know, I only invite people that I like. So they know I like them, but they don't know that you guys like them. So if you do, you know, take a minute and send them a quick note. I'm sure it's greatly appreciated, okay? All right, what else here? Email address, Orbit Radio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, Orbit Radio at AOL.com. And the phone number here in the studio, if you'd like to call during a break, is 1-800-895-KOPN, 1-800-895-5676. That's just sort of a studio line here that I can pick up when I'm not on the air. If we end up taking questions from listeners, I'll give out that number a little bit later for people who want to call in to the program if we decide to do that later with Jonathan, okay? All right, anyway, the email address, one more time, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, at AOL.com, and the website, MikeHagan.com. Upcoming guests, let's talk about that really quickly here. I take it back. It's a few minutes after the hour. I got a couple things I want to take care of before I get too deeply into the program. So I've got a lot of good music tonight, so I'll play a song here from Charles Shea and take a little bit of, a break myself and get some things together, and I'll come back and we'll do more, okay? All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, and Jonathan Zapp coming up on the program in about 45 minutes. We've got great music from Charles Shea all night, and you got me chatting your ear off, okay? So stick around. I'll be back in just a minute. This is called Groovus Maximus. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's Mike Hagan, KOPN Columbia. Groovus Maximus, Charles Shea, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Good evening to y'all. It's Mike. And it's about 20 minutes, not quite, about 17 minutes after the hour of 11 p.m. on the 29th of January, 2007. Man, cruising through time like you can't believe. And, well, I like it because I get to do the show what seems to be more frequently. As time goes faster and faster, it seems like Mondays, you know, are upon me more and more quickly. So even though I only do the show once a week, it seems like I do it more and more often. Anyway, hello to everybody out there. And what do we got going tonight? Jonathan Zapp, as I said, on the web if you want to get a leg up. Jonathan Zapp is located at www.zaporacle.com. And you can also link there directly from my site, obviously. And let me do one quick piece of business here for the station, and then we'll tell you a little bit more about what's going on tonight and what's going on over the next few weeks, okay? All right, make your challenge today. Sometimes we have to make a little noise so we can be quiet later. So with your challenge donation of $240, you can give a gift to two of your favorite nonprofit organizations. The cash will go to KOPN Challenge Fund, and eight spots of underwriting will go to the nonprofit organization of your choice. So you can make some noise right now if you call Julie Baca, 874-1139, and then make your challenge donation. Of course, it's a little bit after 11 o'clock tonight, so Julie's not in the office. You can obviously leave a message or call anytime during business hours, but we've got the pledge drive coming up, one of two that we're going to be doing this year, and I encourage all of my listeners out there to think about what KOPN means to you, and if you think it's a valuable resource for your community, and think about what you pay for other things, you know, cable television or telephone or whatever, and maybe decide if you think it's reasonable to put a little of that hard-earned cash into the KOPN coffers and help the station out here. We exist only because of you, and so I guess I say it in general for the station, and in particular for this program. You know, if you appreciate what happens here on Orbit, well then, you know, I hope you'll try to help us out. And that'll be coming up in the next couple weeks. You can always just go to the website, kopn.org, and donate there. You can donate anything you want, you know, we're not asking for a whole lot of money. We'll take, you know, any donations, and we love to have big, gigantic ones, and we certainly appreciate the small ones as well. And you can do that any time, and if you just put Orbit in the tagline or whatever, then, you know, you've done your thing. And if I see you in the grocery store, you don't have to feel guilty. All right? Anyway, let's get on to business here, okay? Jonathan Zapp tonight, just a little while, all right? Next week, John J. Harper, author of Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century. John J. Harper's great. And, you know, Bruce Lipton wrote the foreword to his book, and it's an interesting book. And another one that's, you know, pretty cogent with the topics of the day. So really sort of excited to have John J. Harper on with us next week. On the 12th of February, get this, I've been talking about it for a few weeks and I'm so excited about it. Visionary artist, the amazing Paul Laffoley. Paul Laffoley, check this guy out. Laffoley. And, you know, just do a quick search for his name and go take a look at some of the things that he does with paint, and then you'll know why I'm having him on the program in a couple weeks. I've also got some amazing new music that I'm excited about to play during that program. So anyway, that's coming up in a couple weeks. The week after that, again, great music we'll have on the 19th of February, but also Judith Ann Brown. And for those uninitiated, Judith Ann Brown is the daughter of John Marco Allegro. And John Marco Allegro is one of the four, or was one of the four, original team members that was sent to Jordan to decipher, translate, and further excavate the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I had a nice long conversation with Judith Ann Brown, who wrote a book about her father. Years after he died, in 1988, and he was a heretic, certainly, or at least considered that by, you know, the mainstream pop Christian culture. But he was a brilliant, brilliant person. And his daughter, Judith Ann Brown, wrote this book called John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I'll tell you more about Judith and about John Allegro. You've heard a lot if you heard Jan Ervin and Andrew Rutaji. If you heard any of the shows that we've done with those guys over the last couple of months, you'll be familiar with Allegro. But I'll talk a little bit about it over the next couple of weeks, and then I'll air this amazing interview that I did with Judith Ann Brown. She's never been on the radio before, by the way. She's never been interviewed by anyone. And anyway, I'm real pleased to be able to bring it and share it with you guys. So that's coming up in a few weeks. The 26th of February is sort of open. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I thought I was going to be out of town. I will be out of town that week. I'm actually going up to South Dakota, to Pine Ridge, to the reservation. And I have some people there that I have to meet with and talk with. But at any rate, I will be here for the show on the 26th of February. And we'll either do an open line show and catch up on the news and that sort of thing, or we'll get a guest to fill in there. I'm sure we have plenty of people that we could talk to that night. We'll just have to see what sort of rolls around, okay? On the 5th of March, Ralph Metzner, Dr. Ralph Metzner, and he requires not a whole lot of introduction from my point of view, at least. If you're a regular listener of this, this program, you'll probably know who Ralph Metzner is, and he's doing great work still to this day, and has been for many decades now. So Ralph Metzner on the air with us on the 5th of March. The 12th, not sure, the 19th, I'm hoping to have Jose Arguelles. John Sheliak, Dr. John Sheliak, of course, the of Time Wave note. And Jonathan, if he's listening, will maybe have a remark or two about Sheliak, I don't know. But anyway, I mentioned it last week, but John Sheliak is a nuclear physicist, and he's also a mathematician, and he is a notable mathematician because he's the guy that got Terence McKenna's time wave theories essentially on, you know, stable mathematical ground. And anyway, he and I have been talking. He's really cool and very, very smart. I'm like, you know, I kind of go, oh, yeah, and then I think to myself, I have no idea what he was just talking about. But anyway, John Sheliak could be on the program sometime in the next month or two, I'm sure. And then I won't go any further than this, but on the 26th of March, Eric John Phelps will talk about the Vatican and the role of the Jesuit order and some conspiratorial stuff, all right? And let's see, Dennis will be back in April, Dennis McKenna, of course, Dale Pendel is still working on that, Jim Beard, Patrick Flanagan, a lot of stuff coming up, but it's going to be a great spring and summer, and I'm looking forward to doing the program with you guys all. All right, so let's see. I have a few announcements here that I'll do before I do space weather, I think, because these are sort of important, and space weather I can always direct you to Kent Stedman's site or a couple other places. You can always check that out for yourself. But anyway, quick announcements here. The Radio Orbit Band / Music Project is underway. And I promised the guys that are working on this that I would mention it. There are some people that have been sort of collaborating through the forum on the website. And, you know, there's some great musicians that hang out over there. And they're collaborating and putting together sort of a, I don't know what to call it really, but an audio project that's, you know, for us, for Orbit. And it's going to be great, and I'm hoping to participate in it myself. But just for everybody out there who's doing it, you guys, I love it. And girls who aren't involved yet, I don't think there are any females involved in the project yet, but damn, do it, you know. These guys are so creative, everyone that's over there doing this, and they've got access to great technology, you know, great recording capabilities, and there's some really talented engineers and producers that can do great mixing and editing that are hanging out at the website over there. So by all means, if you're interested in this stuff, we're going to do more and more of it. So I encourage you to go over to the website and go over to the music section of the forum and you'll see what I'm talking about. But anyway, I'm very excited about it. It's really cool what you guys are doing, and you know, I can't get enough of it. All right, so thanks. All right, another thing, my friend Paul LaViolette in the news. I got an email from Dr. Paul a couple of days ago, and I'm going to read it to you here, all right? Dear Mike, attached is a news release about the early prediction of the Pioneer Effect, or Pioneer Anomaly, which I made 18 years before JPL scientists announced their discovery of the effect. A journal article describing this early prediction appeared in print this month in the journal Physics Essays. Thanks for all your support, Paul. Ha! And the underdog wins one. I love it. Dr. Paul LaViolette. Amazing what he has done. And this is just one small sliver of what Dr. Paul has done and what he is doing. But he predicted the Pioneer Effect, which is the strange shifting of frequency as light moves through the galaxy, through the solar system. And it was unpredicted by the accepted and traditional orthodox physics theories of the day. And Paul LaViolette, speaking of, you know, people who are considered heretics, and in a way he is too. He's had amazing work be completely ignored for many years. And he's a brilliant, brilliant astrophysicist who, you know, has proof now behind many of his claims. Many of the things that Paul predicted, along with the Pioneer Effect, have come to pass, many of them. And I encourage you to look into the work of Dr. Paul LaViolette. You can find him on the web at www.etheric.com. And I also always like to mention his other website that's called Archive Freedom, archivefreedom.org, which is a website that's devoted to, you know, honesty and free flow of information and review of science and scientific theory. And Dr. Paul LaViolette's an amazing guy, and he's a hero of mine. And I'm so pleased that the journal Physics Essays had the courage to print that paper. And the reason it's a big deal is because if you extrapolate what Paul's description really means, the explanation of the Pioneer Effect, and it has to do with something that's called genic energy, G-E-N-I-C. It's a name that Paul sort of coined. At any rate, call it whatever you will. It changes the way that we look at the universe. And it's important for a whole lot of different reasons. And Paul has written a lot of, you know, hard to understand, perhaps, scientific books, subquantum kinetics, you know, that are really basically textbooks for professionals of mathematics and physics. But he's also written some stuff that's, you know, easily understandable by the layperson, like me. This is stuff I read, you know, like, you know, Beyond the Big Bang and Genesis of the Cosmos. And he has a lot of other stuff, but I encourage people to look into his work because he's very, very sharp, and he's had a look ahead of things, if you know what I mean. So good for Paul. Great job. Always doing a great job, but now being recognized in the journal Physics Essays. Wonderful stuff. And it's a big deal because, as I say, the extrapolation of his ideas are big news in physics. All right? What else here? Bertrand Russell, speaking of heretics, or people who make waves, Bertrand Russell, February 2nd, 1970, died. And he was a British man, a philosopher, a logician. I mentioned Kurt Gödel a couple of weeks ago, but Russell was sort of cut from the same cloth. And he was a great writer and a guy who sort of popularized philosophy. He would comment on all kinds of different topics, you know, social commentator of you know, sort of renown, and we talked about all kinds of different things. But he was a mathematician and a scientist as well. He was a big-time anti-war activist as well. And toward the end of his life, I think, took a pretty firm stand against the Vietnam War. And he was old. He was 98 years old when he died. But anyway, he was an interesting guy who wrote, among other things, but what I was introduced to his work through was this gigantic opus that was called Principia Mathematica. And it was basically a writing about logic and philosophy of mathematics. And I have a degree in mathematics, and I always wanted to learn more about why I was being taught what I was being taught and how it came to be that way. Russell was one of the guys that was also interested in this sort of thing. He wrote about the philosophy of language as well, and had a lot to say about how we actually understand things because of words, and how the world really is made of language. You know, something that our friend Terrence was really fond of saying. Anyway, here's to him. Bertrand Arthur William Russell. And passed away again on February 2nd, 1970. Who else? James Joyce. I mentioned James Joyce just a few weeks ago because he was the anniversary of his death was just a few weeks ago. But now we have the anniversary of his birth on the same day as Bertrand Russell's death. Not the same year, of course, but on February 2nd, 1882, James Joyce was born. And I spoke a little bit about him a couple weeks ago, so I won't go into it, but of course he was an amazing writer, an Irishman, Irish writer and poet, widely considered to be, you know, one of the most influential writers of the 20th century. He was known best probably for his amazing novel, Ulysses, which was, of course, banned in the United States in 1921 for 12 years. But also things like all the short stories from The Dubliners, and, of course, Finnegan's Wake. Anyway, James Joyce, amazing stuff, and a wonderful writer and philosopher of sorts on his own, I guess, through his writing. And we'll play another song here, and in honor of all these guys, James Joyce and Bertrand Russell and Paul LaViolette. This one's called Shockwave. It's Charles Shea, and it's KOPN Radio Orbit. It's Mike. You'll be back with me in just a minute. And we'll have Jonathan Zapp in about 25. Continue on from there. Okay, one more time. Shockwave, Charles Shea. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. All right, we heard Shockwave. Good stuff from Charles Shea. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. About 11:45 or so, 11:40 or so in the evening time on the 29th of January, 2007. And glad to be with you tonight. Okay, quick space weather here. A couple of big sunspot areas that just popped up over the last week or so. Great on video, some great photos of these things. If you go over to spaceweather.com, you can check out some of the stuff. But there were some great photos taken that look like this freaking tornado on the sun right now. And both of these spots are worthy of watching in the future. Not a whole lot of action right now, but I think one of them was responsible for a big coronal mass ejection that got tossed over the sun's eastern limb last week. Of course, for me, the big news in space is still the great comet of 2007, Comet McNaught, P1, 2006 McNaught. Holy cow. Listen to this. This is a quote from a guy at an observatory in Australia, right? Because in the southern hemisphere right now, still, Comet McNaught is just an amazing sight, even though it's leaving, our neck of the woods. But anyway, listen to this. He says, "The great comet of 2007 has moved into the morning skies of the southern hemisphere. Comet McNaught was an obvious naked-eye object with 15 degrees of tail visible this morning," reports Gordon Girard of Siding Spring Observatory in New South Wales, Australia. He took this picture at daybreak on the 29th this morning, which was just amazing, and you can go take a look at that over at spaceweather.com. But even though Comet McNaught is receding from the Earth and fading, it remains an easy target for any sort of digital camera and naked eye observation in the southern hemisphere. That's just beautiful. All right, Comet McNaught, nothing like it in a long time, that's for sure. And the images are absolutely stunning. I encourage everyone to go find a way to take a look at some of those pictures of this comet. All right, a great way to do that, actually, is to go over to Kent Stedman's site, cyberspaceorbit.com. Wow, I'm so excited that, Kent was on the air when this thing was really at its peak. That will turn out to be probably, one of my favorite historical shows, because this was an historic event for sure, even though very few people were talking about it. This was, talk about signs in the heavens, baby. This is good stuff happening. All right? Okay, let's see. What else is happening today? January 29th, Cassini, our friendly Saturnian probe, is doing another flyby of Titan, the interesting moon of Saturn. Cassini doing a Titan flyby today. We've got a couple of comets that are also approaching Earth right now. Comet A2 Christensen and W2 Christensen, both discovered over the last couple of years, coming close to the planet, relatively speaking, over the next couple of days. Asteroids Angel and Ben Franklin also coming very close to Earth in the next couple of days, February 1st and 2nd. What else? The February 2nd, 30th anniversary of the burn-up of Salyut 4, one of the space stations from Russia. That was quite a sight if you were looking up in the skies that day. And we also have an asteroid named Mark Twain that's going to get pretty close to the planet on the 3rd of February. Just a few things of note happening up there above your heads. Keep an eye on the moon tomorrow morning. You'll get to see the approach of the Gemini twin stars Pollux and Castor from dusk until dawn on Wednesday morning. And within an hour or so after sunset, if you look west-southwest, you'll see Mercury about 7 degrees just below Venus on Thursday morning. Saturn will be rising in the east, northeast, and you'll see from horizon to horizon actual four official solar system bodies. You'll see Mercury, Venus, the Moon, and Saturn all within about 175 degrees of one another in the sky at the same time. So, anyway, let's see. That's about it with space weather. That's what's happening in the skies above your heads. I'm going to jump on the web here real fast and take a look at the news. Talk about a couple of things here before we get on the air with Jonathan Zapp in just a few minutes. But there's so much going on. I'll take a few extra minutes here to talk about some stuff that we've got happening over there on the forum, some interesting stories that have sort of popped up. All right, what's going on here on the forum? People talking about Paul LaViolette and the Pioneer Effect. Yeah, we mentioned that earlier in the program. People talking about alternative energy. Yes, of course. Water-powered vehicles, people talking about. People talking about Iraq and Iran. You know, the geopolitical situation that's, you know, such a mess that we find ourselves in the middle of. Here's something that I came across the other day that I posted on the forum. I found this great video that's called The Mystery of Chaco Canyon. And Chaco Canyon is this remarkable place in southwestern New Mexico that apparently was the home of a group of Pueblo Indians, native peoples. They called themselves the Anasazi, we think. But anyway, this place, Chaco Canyon, has amazing architecture and a giant, like, Coliseum thing. And there's a place that they call Pueblo Bonito that is just extremely outrageous and mysterious. You know, there are archaeological experts that totally disagree about what happened there. Some people say that it wasn't even a place of residence, that nobody even lived there, that it was a place only of sort of theater. But anyway, Chaco Canyon and the people that built it were something really special. And so that's something that we've got up on the web right now. People are taking a look at. What else? Tesla. The missing secrets of Nikola Tesla. That's being chatted about. Marco Rodin, Rupert Murdoch, and MySpace. A lot of concern about media and, you know, consolidation of media, control of media. Media certainly is, you know, what forms the cultural perception for the most part. And, you know, I was a fan and still am, of course, of Marshall McLuhan, who was, to my mind, still to this day, the most visionary when it came to what was happening with media on this planet. And I think even McLuhan would be surprised by what's happening today. But anyway, there is concern certainly about the TV moguls and the radio moguls and all the people that consolidate media and try to control the message. But again, my opinion as an individual is that we are as free now as we've ever been. And we have access to information like we've never had before. We have access to technologies that allow us to share information like we've never had before. Maybe like no one's ever had before. Or at least not in the records that we keep. And, you know, it's a time to really take advantage and jump in. There's a lot of concern about, you know, control freaks and people who would, you know, go to extremes to manifest their agenda. But that's always been the case. And what we have now is, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, as far as I'm concerned, a leveling of the playing fields of sorts. You know, you, everybody out there, you have the ability to do whatever you want. And you have the ability not only to do what you want, but to share it with everybody else. And that is something else. And as much as you hear about, you know, this group or that group, the New World Order or the Greys or the Communist Party or the Masons or the Templars or the Vatican or the Jews or whoever, you know, sure, you know, there are people vying for power. Okay, there always have been. But There's no one that's being very successful, at least not in my opinion. I think that to seek control in a world like we have today is to do nothing but to just load a tremendous amount of aggravation and, you know, just a tremendous amount of grief into your own body and mind. I mean, if you're a control freak today, you got to just be pulling your hair out. I mean, it's got to be like, you know, it's like trying to control a dream. And granted, I guess some people can do that, but they're always very strange. The dreams, that is. Anyway, lots going on, and lots to participate in this world, and not just observe. Or observe if you don't want to participate, but recognize that there are options available to everyone, you know. All right, what else? A bright object illuminated near Saturn. It's sort of an older story, but still one that hasn't really come to closure. Edgar Cayce, a rare primitive shark captured on film. Wow. Ron Paul for president. I saw Hillary Clinton was going to run for president today. No surprise there. Pollution destroying pre-Aztec Mexican ruins. Well, among other things, certainly. You know, and one other person of note, and I'm glad I saw this as I paged down the forum, Peter Tompkins, who wrote, among other great books, The Secret Life of Plants. He died on the 24th, on Wednesday, just this last Wednesday. He was 87 years old, and he was a journalist and a World War II spy, as a matter of fact, and the author of a number of amazing books, but the one that really got me, that I spoke about actually with Stephen Buhner a couple weeks ago, was called The Secret Life of Plants. And Peter Tompkins was wonderful, and I just, I'm so appreciative for the work that he did and for the writing that he did, because he really inspired a whole group of botanists and ethnobotanists and plant biologists, and really helped a whole new group of people take a different look at the plant world. And for that, again, among other things, you know, I totally commend him. So Peter Tompkins, another one of these amazing people who's sort of stepped off the scene. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll come back in just a few minutes here with Jonathan Zapp. And you can check him out on the web at ZapOracle, ZapOracle.com, ZapOracle.com. And we'll have an interesting conversation for sure with John in just a few minutes, okay? All right, it's Mike. One more time, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Back in a few. This one's called Funkification. You got to love it. It's Charles Shea. And we'll be back in a minute.
listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
Jonathan Zapp, he's a photographer, he's an author, a teacher, an investigator of the paranormal and the strange, someone I like, right up my alley, and a philosopher who has written extensively on human evolution and contemporary mythology. Jonathan was on the program back in October, and we had a whole lot to talk about, and we decided we were going to continue the conversation tonight, so without further delay, we will say hello and welcome back to Radio Orbit, Jonathan Zapp. Hi, John.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. Thanks for being here. All right, let's jump right in here, Jonathan. For people who aren't familiar, you were on the program back in October, so I don't want to do a whole lot of background, but maybe just tell people a little bit about yourself, and then we're going to talk about some questions that have sort of come up from the audience between then and now before we sort of get along with the program tonight, okay?
Okay. So I'll say a little bit about myself.
Please.
Well, some people are calling me a philosopher. I don't know if I have the formal training to justify that, but I'm a writer, a little bit of a paranormal investigator, and I just spend a lot of time thinking and looking into the things that obsess me. I call this the path of the numinous. I think you quoted a little bit from my essay with the same name on my site. And it's taken me to some very strange places. It started with paranormal experiences that I had as a child and adolescent, and in particular things in the culture that really captured my attention as having some uncanny significance, like science fiction movies, very particular ones, and then discovering when I looked into it, that Jung had actually written about the same science fiction fantasy that haunted my childhood when I started investigating. And it's all led me into a strange and long path of looking into many kind of edge phenomena.
Okay. Yeah, and that's exactly what you do. You're sort of an edge runner, an investigator of things out there on the fringe.
Yeah, and it's just whatever is kind of at the fringe of my own psyche, whatever is kind of like hovering and shimmering at that
right,
and
I
horizon.
Guess so all of this has been sort of a personal adventure that's been driven by your own experiences.
Yeah, exactly. And the older I get, the less I'm able to focus in on anything that doesn't really have that tremendous inner interest. That doesn't. It's like somebody once said, "Don't read a book unless it's like a ball of light glowing in your hand."
Right.
I would add, like, don't go to a website, don't listen to a song. I mean, everything, and what's so great is that there really are so many things out there that are like balls of light that really intrigue you, and you just can't know enough about them.
That's the truth, for sure. I run across stuff all the time, and I think you have to do that weigh thing, you know? You have to put the scales up and say, well, is this something that I'm going to devote my time and effort to, or does it fall outside of that? You know, because there, like you say, there's so much going on out there that if you know, you can't experience it all, certainly. So you got to be pretty choosy about the stuff that you put your focus on.
Absolutely, and I mean, there's so much stuff that completely fascinates me that I still don't have time to get to. That it's we're definitely in a time of overload. And some people experience it as information overload, but it's also sort of opportunity overload, because not all of it's information. Some of it's absolutely intriguing and fascinating. And suddenly in the last 10 years with the internet, there's just this blossoming of more portals of fascination than you could possibly have imagined, and are just kind of overwhelmed that, you know, it's hard to take time off from it. because it's so intriguing, and it almost makes the mechanical side of life, I've written about this recently, where you're forced away from what fascinates you into dealing with the physical world in so many ways that we need to survive, it almost makes that seem like an agonizing imposition sometimes.
Yeah, like an inconvenience, you know?
Exactly. I mean, maybe that's the hubris of a baby boomer that's grown up in a world of technology and ever more powerful modalities of media that it feels like I just don't want to deal with all the rest of it. It's kind of like a New Yorker cartoon or something I saw where there are these kids in the back seat of a car and the father is changing a flat and they're on like this deserted country road and the caption, and the father looks very exasperated and the caption reads, "No, you don't understand. You can't change the channel. This is reality." But I kind of would like to see that caption reversed a little bit and to say, like, this is reality, but maybe we can change the channel.
Yeah, I agree with you, certainly. I mean, it seems like you can. If you can't, well, what a dismal outlook that must give you.
Yeah, and that cartoon happened before the Internet, where the monologue of television has now become something where you not only change the channel, but, like, you become the channel. So it's just a completely different way of relating, and I think in some ways it brings into sharper relief our continuing unhappiness with human incarnation. I know it's sort of incorrect to say that because we of course should appreciate and have gratitude for our existing, but there are themes that you know we can see in every great religion and every mystical tradition where it's more or less taken as a given that there's a lot of discomfort with human incarnation.
Right, right. There's so much of it's. Well, first of all, it just seems that it's never enough. I mean, humans are never really satisfied. It seems like it's, but there's also that sort of nostalgia for paradise, you know, that of a long time past and maybe a time in the future where things actually do work out nicely.
Right, it does have that remembering the future quality to it, and I think that this has haunted human beings all along, or at least human beings whose consciousness we could recognize. In the opening scenes of the novel, The Last Temptation of Christ, written by a Greek author whose name I couldn't pronounce even if it was in front of me, but in the opening scenes, an adolescent Jesus is walking up on maybe a hill, and he's looking down at the town in which he lives, and almost everybody in the town is asleep, and the lights have been dimmed and all this kind of stuff, but he kind of senses, in some kind of telepathic empathy, a single thought form that's kind of emerging from all of those sleeping psyches, and it expresses itself in his mind as a single sentence, which is, "Adonai, how long? How long?" You know, just everyone, and that's what everyone is still saying today, of just like, how long is this going to continue before it all changes? And, you know, the answer that every one of us is guaranteed is the event horizon of death.
Right.
But many people also project that onto an eschaton or end time, and often when they did that, they were confusing their own personal event horizon, that confusion that's always happening in the human psyche of inner and outer, with a collective end, which in some ways is less anxious to think about. And so we are, however, you know, everyone's expectation of that being just up ahead has always been disconfirmed. But we live in a time where, with better reality testing, it really does seem like things are intensifying in completely unprecedented ways.
Oh, that is for sure, and it's in some ways tangible, but in many ways intangible. You know, it's funny because I live in this college town, you know, Jonathan, and there's 35,000 20-somethings around here, right?
Right, I'm in a college town too.
Yeah, so yeah, you're up in Boulder,
right?
And good for you. We mentioned it before. Columbia and Boulder actually have some parallels. But at any rate, I hang out a lot about town and that. And before the program, all the time on Monday nights, I'm downtown, and I always sort of just try to get a feel for the pulse, you know, of the zeitgeist around town. And let me tell you, man, even these kids who are young and without a whole lot of experience in, you know, who knows what, they're all feeling it too. They're saying, well, gosh, I don't know what's happening, but something is happening and something's got to give.
Right. I mean, it's the thing that always has to be added to that, even though I feel that so strongly myself, is that, well, so did the Christians of the first century A.D. who wrote Revelations.
Right, right.
The expectation that was happening in their lifetime.
Right. They didn't write that as a future prognostication. They thought that was coming then, right?
Right. And it was, in a sense, because, first of all, we all have our own personal event horizon.
Again, yes. Okay.
And also because if we take that event horizon, sort of take away linear time, and those countdown calendars that people sort of unfortunately get wrapped up in, then it is always there, because it was always, like what Terence called a strange attractor, it was always something woven into the way reality was structured. I think there are formed and unformed elements in the future, and the unformed ones are what give an opportunity for free will, but some are formed, though they may be sort of loosely formed, like the fact that each of us will die within 100 years is probably a formed reality.
Right,
but the exact time of it may or may not be. It might be the Earth is destined to be hit by an asteroid at a time that could be predicted with total exactitude if we but knew where the asteroid was.
Right, right.
Or it could be based on your dietary choices, or that, you know, oncoming car you didn't notice on the freeway or whatever.
Mm.
And so, similarly, we really don't know, and we don't have to know when that's going to happen. But the species has a life cycle, just as the individual body within the species has a certain lifespan. The small part recapitulates the whole, like in a hologram or
right.
a fractal.
Right.
And so it's already included in there, and just like it's included in your bodily reality, no matter how young and healthy you are, that recognition that this is a process that ends at a certain point. And so people at any point in history are going to feel that event horizon and register it in their own way.
Right, some great change just over the horizon.
Exactly.
Okay, all right. Wow, well, it's certainly something that I feel personally, and I, you know, it's weird. You try to parse it out and say, okay, well, is this just me projecting, you know, or is there really something more going on than there was going on in the first century?
I think we could make a much better case for that than people in any other time, because there are so many unprecedented elements. If we were merely living through a wartime and social upheaval like the Christians of the first century AD, well, that's not very unprecedented. But the technologies that we have are unprecedented, and they are reshaping the human psyche. They are an evolutionary lathe that is changing things at an incredible pace. The metabolism of the species is heating up. There are more of us than there ever were before, at least as far as we can tell. And so we have much more claim to feel an unprecedented intensification going on.
Wow, makes great sense. And like you say, there are lots of different areas of endeavor that you can argue it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it'd be the easiest thing in the world to argue. I can't even imagine anyone able to formulate a counter-argument. This is business as usual. But some people will say, like, oh, well, you know, history just repeats itself. And yeah, there are a lot of classic things, just like somebody maybe has come up with a list of, you know, 12 basic stories, and you can create variations of them, but it's hard to create a different one that works. Yeah, the cycles repeat, just like the archetypes of the hexagrams of the I Ching, interesting slip, repeat, but in unprecedented ways. And some of you people in the chat room were asking, maybe this would have to be a future time to talk about what's happening with evolution and images and in visual language.
Mm-hmm.
But that's happening right now. We don't have to have willing suspension of disbelief and stretch our imaginations out to some extrapolated future to claim that there is a radical evolution that is changing us neurologically and changing our consciousness in the most profound ways. It is, the evidence of it is all around us. If anything, it's hard to step away from it a bit just to locate what's going on. But the evidence of it is I think, hard to argue.
Okay. All right, look, we're about a quarter after here, and I want to get to a couple of questions, actually one in particular that came up from a number of listeners in between the last time we were on the air and now, okay?
Sure.
And it basically has to do with the concept of mind parasites that we talked about toward the end of the program last time when we were on the air in October. And you mentioned something that you call the X factor. And a number of listeners sort of took that as a cliffhanger because we didn't talk enough about it. But essentially, we had been talking at the time about just some of this over-the-top darkness that we've seen in history and why we just can't figure out what is happening. And then you brought up this idea of an X factor. So maybe you could clarify that a little bit and talk a little bit about it before we take a break here, okay?
Absolutely. Well, the X factor way of framing the mind parasite subject came to me when I was in a wilderness isolation phase, and I had a book with me that was eyewitness accounts throughout history. And some of these items dated back to hundreds of years before Christ, and they went all the way up to events after World War II. And as I started reading these, I just saw how most of them were accounts of, like, mind-numbing horror. And that the most dramatic and the most surreal in their horrific aspects were in the 20th century, culminating in reports about the Holocaust, and then seeming even more bizarre in some of the reports from the Gulag archipelagos of the old Stalinist Soviet Union, where there was
millions.
This over-the-top aspect. Like, for example, and I never realized this, KGB agents would pick basically some completely ordinary Russian citizen, someone who hadn't even committed sins that a communist, an Orthodox communist, would recognize, and they would pick that person out to persecute. And instead of just dragging them off, which they could so easily do, they would, like, have an agent spend hours with them at a bar, pretending to be their friend, just to make the denunciation more horrific and surreal.
Right.
And so there's this over-the-top aspect that we see, like, in the weirdness of serial killers and in so many different things in our culture. And no one, I think, has successfully come up with a theory to really explain that. Why are we the animal that does such surreal evil, given that we seem to be the most intelligent, or at least among the most intelligent of creatures? Why do we come up with this and no one else? And I think the mind parasites is just one theory that attempts to account for that X factor aspect.
All right, and mind parasites, for people who didn't hear that first program or who aren't familiar with the concept, is basically an idea of
alternate species that we live with but may not recognize, but that are huge players in our existence. And the comparable example I use is the microbiological realm that went completely unrecognized by every culture until some Danish shopkeeper invented the microscope. And we discovered this vast area of life, and not only was there this vast cryptozoology of strange forms that we would only begin to map out, and it would take us, we're still working on that, but we would actually be made out of such creatures. Some 20 trillion of these microorganisms make up who we are. Imagine how staggeringly bizarre that would be. And right now we live in a culture that has a cultural blind spot to energetic organisms, which are recognized basically by every culture, and Judeo-Christian culture as well, every culture but fundamentalist materialism. And wherever we find a realm of life, in the microbiological plane, the extremophobes, whatever, we always find symbionts, parasites, and predators.
Mm.
And the most common life form are parasites. They outnumber amongst terrestrial species, according to totally straight biological science, any other kind of life forms, 5 or 6 to 1.
Wow.
So the X factor may be that there are species that we are not aware of, or at least that scientific materialism, scientism is not aware of, but that are huge players in what happens, often unseen players. And we think of ourselves as on top of the food chain, that may be a delusion very convenient to those that actually are on top of the food chain. Harvest our negative energies and create these over-the-top forms of surreal evil that are, like, terrible and terrorist and, you know, just horrifying for that very purpose, to create a food of negative emotions.
Which another species feeds on.
Exactly.
Amazing. Okay. All right. So, the X factor, there you have it, all right? Look, we had a we both had a couple of weird, like, synchronistic things happen, and then we talked to each other on the phone a couple days ago.
Right.
And so I want to talk about oracles.
Sure.
And at first, I'd like to start, you have your own oracle, and, you know, the website, for the people out there who didn't hear the first time or the second time that I mentioned it, it's Zap Oracle, ZAPORACLE.com. And it's a word that's probably not very well understood by most people. I think probably, like many words, people have their own idea of what it might mean. Let me know, Jonathan, in your own worldview and through your lens, what an oracle is to begin with. I want to talk generally about it, and then let's talk about some specific oracles, including yours, as we sort of move along here, okay?
Okay. Well, an oracle is a microcosm, and the cosm that we experience, that you can call the matrix or just the world that we live in, is also an oracle, and that's why there are portents and synchronicities that come up, and often the world we experience in the regular waking life functions as an oracle itself. But the difference when you consult an oracle is you are consulting now a microcosmic, lower resolution representation of the larger oracle or the larger cosmos in which we live. And particularly featured in that microcosmic universe of the oracle are archetypal signifiers. These will be the I Ching hexagrams, the tarot cards, the runes with assigned meanings, and so forth. And it's extremely important that as many archetypes as possible can be represented, and that they not all be warm and fuzzy ones. That's why an oracle like angel cards seems, you know, destined to be part of a shallow new age thing, because it doesn't represent the shadow. It doesn't represent the full range of human possibilities, which has to include tragic possibilities and all sorts of different things.
Right.
And basically, you approach this microcosm and its archetypal signifiers through a conscious synchronicity. It's like you invite the principle of synchronicity in by some process that looks mechanical and random to the materialist's eye, the naive mind of the materialist, but that is hopefully a synchronicity. I say hopefully because there are some times when the synchronicity may not happen, and that could be have its own meaning. But you create a pattern in space-time at that moment through these objects that you interact with that's going to reflect the inner pattern of your psyche and give you, like a mirror, like Galadriel's mirror, but maybe hopefully less deceiving, and a reflected image of what you are going through. And that will help you to understand it, because it gives you a kind of triangulation point. You're so embedded in your own process and states of change and energy and so forth that it's hard to see it. But now when the oracle can mirror that to you, it's extremely helpful.
Synchronicity. You mentioned it a couple times. What is it?
Well, it's a term that was coined by Carl Jung, I guess in the 1940s, after he had some dinner conversations with Einstein and he worked closely with the physicist Wolfgang Pauli. Jung was knew that there was a principle in reality not recognized in the West that was required to account for the strange but inconsistent tendency for events in the physical world to weirdly parallel events in the psychic world. This came up so often in his studies and in his work with patients he knew that there had to be some way to, some principle of the way reality functions to explain that. Like, for example, Jung had a patient who was excessively rationalistic, and that was preventing progress in her analysis. And one day she came to her session with Jung and was very excited because she had a big dream. And in the dream, Jung gave her a golden scarab, an Egyptian symbol of immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And just as she's getting to that part of the dream, I might have a detail off or two here, but he hears a tapping on the window of his consultation room. And he opens the window, and a golden scaraboid beetle, not native to the area of Switzerland where his office was, flies into the room. Jung catches it in his hand, and just as she gets to that part of the dream, he opens his hand, and there's the golden, living golden scaraboid beetle. And that intense synchronicity punctured her rationality, and she was able to progress.
Right, that's the resolution of her issue, right?
Right, and so Jung asks, like, what causal factor would have, you know, caused this beetle to demand admittance to a darkened room against every natural instinct? So these uncanny parallelisms that most of us notice are what are called synchronicities, and he calls it an acausal connecting principle. The idea is that there's just no firewall between the world of the psyche and the world of matter. They seem to be part of a continuous field, even though the Cartesian dualism that you know most of our upbringing was based on somehow created an imaginary firewall between the psyche and the outside world.
Amazing.
Part of the disenchantment of the world.
Right. Wow. All right, look, that's a good place to take us a little break here, I think, okay?
Sure.
We'll do that. We'll come back and we'll talk more about oracles, and we'll talk about, I want to ask you about Delphi. I don't know how much we'll talk about it, but we'll talk a little bit about that. And I want to talk about your own oracle and what the idea behind Zap Oracle is. And then we'll talk about the I Ching, all right?
Okay.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We've got Jonathan Zap with us on the air for the next hour and a half live from his place in Boulder, Colorado. You can check him out on the web at www.zaporacle, ZAPORACLE.com, zaporacle.com. And we'll come back with Jonathan in just a minute. In the meantime, we'll have a piece of music here from Charles Shea. This one is called On the Way, and that's what we are. We'll come back, talk more about oracles, lots of other things with Jonathan Zap in just a few minutes. It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia. On the Way. That's Charles Shea. And this is Mike Hagen. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, about 12:35 now in the AM on the 30th of January. Can you believe it? Well, I can believe it. It's cold enough outside that I can believe it. I keep thinking the ice is going to melt. We have so much ice here. It's outrageous. People are just falling everywhere. But, you know, I guess you got to keep your balance. That's one of the keys these days. So, anyway, all right, it's Mike, and I'll stop rambling, and I'll get back to my guest, Jonathan Zapp. He's with us on the air from Boulder, on the web at Zapp Oracle, ZAPORACLE.com, Zapp Oracle. And hello, Jonathan.
Yes.
So,
good to be back.
Yeah, good. Thanks for sticking around. What is it? It's about 11:30 in Colorado time, huh?
Yes. The time feels like it could slow down at any moment here just because of the cold. We're having a brutal winter, so I hope the parallels between Boulder and Columbia do not extend into the weather.
Man, they have. You know, it's funny because, you know, I lived in Colorado for quite some time, so I've got threads that take me back there, and I've talked to lots of my friends in Boulder and in Denver, and they're just like, oh my gosh, Mike, you can't believe what's going on.
We've never had winter like this here.
One of my best friends, Jonathan, is another guy. His name is John, and he's a cab driver in Denver, and you can't believe the stories he's telling me. You know. So anyway, yeah, weather just completely outrageous for Denver and for here as well. So anyway, okay, let's talk more about oracles, all right? There are lots of different kinds of oracles. You mentioned the I Ching, you mentioned the tarot. I have a couple of listeners that said, ask Jonathan why Delphi is so special. In other words, when people hear about Delphi or oracles, a lot of times the oracle of Delphi, for whatever reason, comes to mind. Is there anything particularly interesting for you about Delphi?
Well, one thing that's interesting about it is that one way of interacting with the oracle is through another person. And so that's one thing that was happening at Delphi is you could interact with the deck of cards, you could interact with these objects, but often in every tradition of oracles, sometimes you're interacting with a person who is there to kind of channel the oracle for you. Now, there's been speculation about what types of visionary medicines the oracles may have used. Whether, to me, that's not as interesting as just the idea that somehow or another they were able to channel that oracular force, and without any sort of symbolic system that they were drawing from, rather than not consulting a book or a deck of cards, but just, you know, the Akashic record itself or something, apparently. And that is possible. Sometimes we'll have a person speak in a kind of oracular voice for us. Like I've seen many cases of where one person has a dream for somebody else, where the dream seems to have more of a message for another person in their life than themselves. So people can sometimes become oracles. The thing that's really distasteful, though, is when people think they're oracles, but they're not. You see a lot of that out there.
Isn't that the truth?
So that's why... putting on that oracle hat is something that any sensible person does with a lot of uneasiness, that it doesn't become a clown suit.
Well, let's talk about Zapp Oracle. Speaking of people who have sort of taken on an oracle, you have done this yourself. Let's talk about what Zapp Oracle is.
Okay, and I sort of did it myself. It sort of came into existence in ways that I couldn't fully control or anticipate, and sort of by its own serendipitous nature. It started in a very humble way. I was just started a collection of art postcards. I lived in New York City, and I was grew up going to art museums, and eventually I had a stack of these cards. And I put them in my camera bag, and I would pick cards and put them up with refrigerator magnets on the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point I decided to, instead of picking them myself, to just close my eyes and pick them. And I started to notice that there were synchronistic connections with the themes of the week in the cards that I picked. I just discovered that it was operating as a kind of oracle. And probably what helped it act as an oracle was that the cards in my collection were ones that were numinous for me, that had some kind of uncanny significance, that related to the things, the archetypes that obsessed me.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they were functioning as an oracle without my even intending it to be so. When I noticed that, then I started interacting with it consciously as an oracle, didn't have to wait for the weekly four-card thing on the fridge, though that's how I used it for years, and other people started interacting with it too. Then I started doing readings with it, sometimes to parallel I Ching readings. And then just in the last few years, the oracle really began to mutate with a very simple suggestion that, amazingly enough, it never occurred to me, because I always called it the image oracle. A friend of mine said, well, why don't you add captions to the cards? And I guess I just needed somebody else to say that, to give me some kind of inner permission. I started doing that, and then the whole possibility of a website and putting on the internet came to me just a couple of years ago, and through a set of very propitious coincidences, I happened to run into somebody that knew how to do that and was willing to do it for free, and just kind of magically got a lot of help that I could not call up if I were to, you know, work my phone chain for weeks.
Is that would we consider that synchronicity or not?
No, not strictly, because a lot of things are called synchronicities, even things that I sometimes call synchronicities, that wouldn't really hold up to an exact definition, because if you can think of any kind of causal mechanism, or even if you even possible causal mechanisms, then it wouldn't really count as a synchronicity, but there can be synchronistic elements
that can push you in a certain direction, and then maybe things unfold the way they unfold.
Right, like an example of what might be a synchronicity in this case is, you know how many astrologers will study the exact time of the origin of a person or an enterprise or a corporation or a government to learn things about its nature. So the astrologers examine the character of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's July 4th, 1776,
right,
as the point of origin. Well, the Oracle as an online entity had a very strange point of origin. I was, the project had been kind of, you know, stalled, and the people that were working on it had other things, you know, occurring to them, but somehow one of them called me, it was on Halloween evening, and then he got the other person, the webmaster, Drew, on the phone, and we had this three-way phone conversation while I was just biking back from somewhere in Boulder, and while we were on the phone, these two computer masters did their magic and brought the Oracle online on Halloween Eve. An unlikely night for people to, you know, everyone should have been at a party or something. I guess we must have all been revealing ourselves as unsociable geeks or something. But this phone call happened to happen. And it was also the eve before a huge medical transition in my family. My mom was going in for open heart surgery at Mount Sinai the next day. So it was a very intense night. Unfortunately, it worked out very well. And so that's an example of synchronicity in that there was no or possible synchronicity in that no one really intended, no one set out to say, like, let's do this on Halloween Eve.
Right.
But then I realized, like, wow, this is the perfect time to bring this thing into being.
Amazing.
And the other thing going on with that oracle is that it is open-ended in the sense that I'm adding cards all the time, new ones, largely from my own photographs. And the reason why I'm doing this is the more archetypal signifiers you have in an oracle, it's kind of like having more neurons in a brain. It's capable of higher resolution synchronicities.
Right, better descriptions.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of one card to represent the shadow, if there are 50 of them, then it may catch that particular flavor that you're in right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I plan to add more and more cards to it. And I think that, you know, people talk about AI and that maybe it would appear in the Internet, because the Internet is the most complex and unanticipated merging of all these different artificial intelligences.
Mm.
And people still, even in that more organic model, imagine it as coming out of the hardware. But what if intelligence is something implicit in the universe that if you have a sufficiently complex substratum of some sort, it just manifests itself?
Right, and it could be different sorts of substrate.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you created the right machine, that would then become like a fetus in the womb,
right.
A potential vessel for mind to unfold.
Right, and Jonathan, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think more and more we're learning that intelligence is not necessarily confined to the human realm. You know what I mean? I have I talk a lot about shamanism, you know, and intelligence in nature and this sort of thing on the program. And I had one of my favorite guests. His name is Stephen Herod Buhner, who was on a few weeks ago, and he has written a number of books about this sort of thing, but makes the most beautiful argument, and I hate to even use the word argument because it's not an argument, it's just a beautiful description of intelligence in nature. And it's not intelligence in a new age, you know, frou-frou sense. It's real intelligence. And I think that the more we recognize that, you know, there are other intelligent species that may just act out in a different way that we may not so easily recognize as intelligence because of our narrow scope of the situation, but it's intelligence nonetheless. And I don't see it as that big of a stretch to move that into areas maybe that are not so organic.
Well, absolutely. It is part of the disenchantment of the world, which is very eloquently described in 60 or 70 of the most important pages you could ever read, on the beginning of a book called Cosmos and Psyche by Richard Tarnas.
Richard Tarnas, sure. Yeah.
And so we live in a time, the time of fundamentalist materialism, where we have to rediscover the inherent intelligence that exists in the organic world and in matter itself, though crystals and complex organisms and stars and all these astounding, well-organized systems and objects surround us. And not only does intelligence exist in animate and inanimate objects around us, but it also exists in objects that are harder to classify, like the I Ching. It's not an organism as we conventionally think of it. It's not an object because there are all these different books of different kinds, different translations, different versions. There are people using it. You know, what exactly is it? Many people call it an entity. And in fact, there was a convention of talking about it as the little old man in the yellow coat or something like that, because the Wilhelm Baines I Ching is yellow or something.
That's right.
But parents and many people have talked about it. Not only is it an entity, it's an entity with a certain personality, like a very particular sort of sense of humor at times as well. And so these oracular microcosmic objects seem to take on a life of their own. And in fact, there was a particular night just a couple months ago where I was riding my bike again and wasn't even thinking about it. Suddenly, some totally unexpected intuition came up that the Zap Oracle was now an entity, whatever that meant.
Right.
When I got home, it was such a strong feeling, I went on the statistics page and I noticed that on that particular day there was a huge spike of traffic to the site and to the Oracle.
Wow.
So when we started talking about AI and intelligence occurring in the net, if you create an Oracle, you are creating a substrate through which intelligence can be channeled from the universe. Because now that you have a microcosm of archetypal signifiers, it's capable of channeling an intelligence that does not have to arise out of hardware, but the hardware or the elements in your system act as a kind of transceiver of that intelligence.
All right, well, you mentioned the I Ching. We talked about oracles in general, and there are lots of different kinds. The I Ching is one that is a very interesting one to me because I like to mess around with it, and I should watch my language is what I should do. I don't mess around with it. I take it pretty seriously. I don't do it often. I do it like a psychedelic. Not very often, and when I do it, I'm very serious about it.
That's a good way to do it.
But it's as occult as anything. It's as occult as throwing the bones or the tarot or a Ouija board. But for whatever reason, to me, it's always seemed like it really worked. I mean, it's the strangest thing when you throw the coins and then open the book, you know, to your particular hexagram that was drawn out of the whole thing. But my gosh, Jonathan, I can count on less than one hand the number of times when it wasn't really cogent. I mean, dead smack between the eyes.
Yeah, once you've had a certain number of those experiences, you just start becoming a believer, no matter how skeptical you are. And I was brought up by people who were steeped in the scientific method. My mom was a person who would evaluate, like those peer-reviewed studies. She would evaluate their scientific methodology, and in almost every case find it deeply flawed and thought probability. So I was just brought up with that deeply skeptical attitude, and, you know, this could all be random, I could be projecting into it. But then when you have particular cases, like you ask about a particular relationship, you get two hexagrams with two changing lines, and then you go back a day later, you know, wanting a better result, and you get the same two hexagrams, the same two changing lines. Tremendous odds.
Yeah, I'm the same. I had the same thing happen. People think I'm a flake, but I have a degree in mathematics and with a minor in physics, and I speak German.
Right.
You know, and I'm very interested in science and mathematics and all this stuff, but I just recognize them as tools and not as meta theories. You know.
Right. I'll give you a couple of quick examples that might help convince some people. I shouldn't even say convince. The I Ching actually doesn't ask you to believe in it. It actually wants you to be a skeptic. It wants you to have an open mind, not to be a debunker, which is a true believer in a negative, but to have a show-me attitude and be empirical about it and only take things that resonate with your inner truth sense. And like one time, 1995, I was about to leave my former life and pack up myself off into this little RV and just head out into the unknown. And then still living in the RV, actually, 11 years later. And I had this brilliant RV mechanic who was a mechanical genius, but he kind of a warrior, and he said, like, you're putting too much in there. You can't handle the weight. You'll never make it across the country. But maybe if you put all the weight between the axles, other people said, oh, he's a warrior, you'll be just fine. So I go to the I Ching with us because it's a serious issue.
Right.
And I get a changing line that says, I'm paraphrasing slightly, I don't have in front of me, but it says, like, the great cart will take you on the great journey, but put the weight between the axles. Okay, so just a few weeks after I set out on that journey, maybe just like 3 weeks later, or maybe even 10 days later, I was at my first National Rainbow Gathering, and suddenly, just walking into the gathering, it occurred to me that I could provide a service here. I could do free dream interpretation and I Ching readings. It never occurred to me, but it just seemed so one of those intuitions that seems totally obvious once you've thought about it. Well, like maybe the second day that I set up with my little sign, a young man came to me asking for an I Ching reading, and he said, here's my situation. I became addicted to crystal meth, and I'm really desperate. I've left my hometown because everybody I know there is hooked on this, and I really don't know what to do, and I just came to this gathering looking for some kind of answers. And my father always told me that if I ever really needed an answer, to go to the I Ching, and that if I ever really needed to get in touch with him, to go to the I Ching. And his father was apparently a drug addict, and he said, if anything ever happens to me and I'm no longer here, go to the I Ching for a message.
Right,
his father had died,
and
so he said, so here I am. I'm coming to the I Ching to hear from my father. And I'm like, whoa. I'm like sweating. I mean, I hope the I Ching is up to this. I hope I'm not going to get some like vague generalities or like holy high stakes I Ching reading. So anyway, but I'm not in control of it. So I'm just like, okay. He tosses the coins. He gets one changing line, and it says, "The son must take responsibility for his own behavior. No blame on the departed father."
Wow.
Okay? And it, just like December 20-something, I was in New York, and my parents wanted to talk to me about their will. They wanted to rewrite it, and they were asking me for all these suggestions. We had this long talk about it, and at the end of it, they said, "Well, are there any other things you can think of?" And they've now become open to the I Ching, despite their scientific backgrounds. And I said, "Well, why don't we go to the I Ching and see what it says about, you know, this new thing you've created?" And they get a changing line that says, talks about a funeral, and that says, "The will is not yet prepared." And of course, these ideas had to be taken to the lawyer to, like, you know, prepare a new will. And so that was, you know, a staggering example. And this kind of thing can happen very frequently in your interaction with the I Ching. You just realize you're talking to something that cannot possibly be random.
All right. And the hardware side of it, for people who aren't familiar, it's a book, and there are a number of ways to sort of approach this thing. You have yarrow sticks, or we have coins. I prefer to use the coins. I don't know if you have a particular method that you use.
I use the coins, too, which is maybe a 1,000-year-old method, and sometimes I use a new method that uses glass pebbles, but that duplicates the odds of the yarrow stock method, if you think that's important. I don't really.
Yeah, I don't either, really.
Right.
I think it's just sort of a doorway that you use to get in there or whatever. But
exactly.
But, again, for people unfamiliar, the book itself, the I Ching, perhaps one of the oldest books we know of. It's at least 5,000-6,000 years old.
Yeah, it's considered the world's oldest book, far older than the oldest books of the Bible. It's really the mother source of all Asian culture, and it predates just about anything else from the East you can think of. Like, the following are based on the I Ching: Taoism, Tai Chi, Qigong, Feng Shui, Chinese medicine, acupuncture, Chinese cuisine, the Tao Te Ching, Zen Buddhism is largely inspired by it. So it's right at the start of Asian culture, as far as we know, and in addition to being considered the world's first book, it's also considered the world's first computer.
Mm.
It's a binary system. The hexagrams are structures that are made of broken or solid lines, are basically zeros or ones.
Mm-hmm.
They indicate a yin or a yang, a zero or a one. And if people want to see what they look like, they can go to the main page of my site. I just linked up a little introduction to I Ching, and they'll see pictures of hexagrams, if that gives them a visual aid at all.
Yes, yes. I went there myself just a little while ago. Thanks for putting that up.
Awesome. And so these hexagrams have a very peculiar mathematical structure that interested our friend Terence McKenna, and also that turns up elsewhere in culture and in nature. Like, for example, the chessboard is made up of 64 light and dark squares, 64 hexagrams of light and dark lines.
Right, and there are 64 hexagrams in the I Ching.
Right, and it also turns out that there are 64 codons in human DNA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there have been books written about the connection between human DNA and the I Ching. I think it was one of Jung's most brilliant colleagues, Marie-Louise von Franz, that might have been the first to notice this parallelism in the early 1960s when she became aware of some of the details about how DNA was structured. And these binary codons that are instructions to build proteins, apparently there are even structural similarities between particular of the 64 codons and hexagrams that have the same binary structure. There are two codons that sort of pause that protein building process, sort of like emulsify, pause, do something else, a sequence of commands. Well, they correspond in structure to the I Ching hexagrams retreat and stagnation. And then the ancient Chinese ideogram that means I Ching, there's a picture of it also in that document, looks like a DNA double helix. So it seems that ancient peoples, just like people today, have this potential for gnosis, of inner knowing, because our bodies are made of the same stuff of the universe, that the quantum mechanical basis of reality, these underlying structures, are knowable without super colliders and radio telescopes. They're knowable by just contemplating within if you're some kind of visionary. And the I Ching seems to have come out of that point of view. Though there are ways of seeing how it could have been serendipitously developed without any particular individual even understanding totally what they were doing. That's a whole other theory about the origin of the I Ching. But there are basically 64 classic patterns of energy and change. And they're all really familiar because we are patterns of energy and change. And we go through certain classic cycles, like a time to heroically gather your will to overcome a huge obstacle. That could be a dramatic moment in your life, or it could just be trying to wake up in the morning where you're kind of like in this yin state and you're totally passive and you need to kind of summon that inner fire to get out of bed. Well, that's like a hexagram. You might be going through 10 or 11 hexagrams before you even have breakfast.
Right.
To see how a hexagram is a pattern of energy and change and how it relates to these solid and broken lines, the one I usually use to illustrate it is hexagram 24, which is easy to picture in your mind. It's just a solid line on the bottom with five broken lines above it.
Mm-hmm.
And so those broken lines are the yin, they're the zeros, they're like the dark principle, and the solid line is the yang, the light principle. And you build hexagrams from the bottom up, so the bottom line is the first place. It represents the newest energy. So basically, this is a situation where after the dark principle has maxed out, which would be six broken lines, number two, the receptive, now a new young light energy is coming into the situation, and it's called the turning point. Well, that's like the moment of first moments of dawn, where after the night got as dark as it could, now light energy is entering.
Right.
In the calendar, it's the winter solstice.
Which we've just passed recently.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. In the economy, the first signs of economic growth after a long recession or depression. Interpersonally, the first signs of new understanding in a relationship that had long been estranged. Psychologically, the first steps toward returning to your real essence after a long period of negative acquired conditioning, and so forth. You can relate it to any process because it's just a classic pattern.
Right, and it's an alchemical pattern.
Exactly.
All right, Jonathan, look, we got to take a break. We're top of the hour, okay?
Sure.
Yeah, everybody, wonderful stuff. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the I Ching, and then we're actually going to, I don't know how we're going to do it, Jonathan. Hopefully you've thought about it more than I have in the last few hours, but we're going to do some sort of a collective reading or something. We're going to throw the coins. I have my coins here. I'm sure you have yours. And we're going to do something and consult the I Ching. We'll talk more about it after the top of the hour here with Jonathan Zapp. On KOPN Radio Orbit, it's Mike, and just a couple minutes after the top of the hour, 1 a.m. now on the 30th of January, we'll play another song here from Charles Shea, and we'll come back, as I said, and we'll talk about the I Ching and actually do a reading with Jonathan Zapp, and you can find information about John on the web at www.zapporacle.com. All right, this is Pixie Pranks. From Charles Shea. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. Back in a few. Dixie Pranks. Again, good music there from Charles Shea. If you're interested in finding out more about Charles, by the way, you can go to cdbaby.com, cdbaby.com, and just put in Charles Shea in the search engine there, and you can find out a little bit of information about Charles and maybe download a few songs. And we'll also link him up in the music archives after this program as well. I'm sure Larry will take care of that for us, okay? All right, anyway, great stuff. And that CD, by the way, is called Creation. And once again, the artist is Charles Shea. All right, and my guest this evening is Jonathan Zapp. You can find information about Jonathan on the web at www.zapporacle.com. And, well, Jonathan, we were talking about the I Ching right there before the break. And I'm thinking, you know, we talk often about the Wilhelm Baines version or translation of the Book of Changes. In that particular book, Carl Jung makes a contribution, and he essentially consults the oracle itself and sort of tries to interview the I Ching in a sense. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, and then maybe how we might approach what we might try to do here in a few minutes.
Okay, and that is absolutely something you can do. You, in fact, people write stories with the I Ching as the co-author. For example, the most recent essay I wrote called The Mechanical Resistance Matrix, the first part was just like a kind of surreal spilling out of what I was feeling, and then I wanted to come up with a philosophy for dealing with mechanical resistance and realized, well, you know, I'm not really exactly the right person to do this because I'm a person that struggles with that a lot myself, so I'm just going to go to the I Ching. And the second half of the essay was basically my reporting the hexagrams and expounding on what they meant, and the I Ching just came in like it was just completely already and just gave the perfect philosophy right out of the hexagram set that was created while I was writing this essay in one giant writing session. So the I Ching is absolutely able to do that, and I forgot to mention to people that I'm not an I Ching scholar, and my approach to the I Ching is purposely non-traditional, because, you know, this is the Book of Changes, and the Taoists even had a problem with words. You know, the way that can be told is not the real way.
Words
are static.
Right, if it can be told, it can't cover it all, sure.
Right, because the Tao is ever-changing. Words are, once they're committed to paper, become static. With the exception, of course, if they're words in an oracle, because then that it brings in a whole new dynamic feature. And therefore, what was traditional, this is my attitude toward any religion or toward any ritual or toward anything, needs to be constantly reforming itself and changing and hybridizing with new things that have come up, and particularly the I Ching, which is the Book of Changes.
Right, it even tells you that in its title, right?
Exactly. Ching basically just means like book or text or something, a canon. And I, it's believed, means lizard. And the lizard they had in mind is possibly the chameleon. It's a changeling. And so therefore, I feel as much as I love the Wilhelm Baines, and for my first 20 years with the I Ching were probably all the Wilhelm Baines, but I've brought in other versions, and there are some that are just terrible. Like the one that's endlessly reprinted, Leg, that even Jung kind of disses in his introduction.
Right.
It was this old British sinologist who didn't really believe, thought it was a bunch of superstitious nonsense. But his translation appears everywhere to this day because I guess it's not copyrighted because it's so old. But it's just terrible. So there are some versions that are just awful, and there are others that are worth their weight in gold plus platinum. But a great thing about the Wilhelm Baines is that it's metaphorical. And some of the translations, the plain English versions that I use, are great, but they don't have those rich metaphors, which can give, like, multidimensional meanings. But also, because the I Ching is based, Taoism, and it is based on the I Ching, and its Book of Changes, spontaneity is very important. So, like, even minutes before the show, and in fact, even 15 minutes ago, I didn't know what we were going to ask the I Ching. I just said, let it be open to synchronicity or to something, and I just couldn't think of it because I could think of problems with every sort of thing we might want to ask about. So then, just when we cut to the break, I'm like, well, this is it, and I just decided, let me ask the I Ching what we should ask about. So I just did a really quick hexagram, and what I got was peace, hexagram number 11, where which just has three broken lines on top, three yang lines on the bottom. The top, the earth element, moves downward. The yang, or heavenly element, moves upward. So the two forces come to meet in a perfect way.
Right, the union of heaven and earth.
Right, so it doesn't just mean peace in the sense of tranquility. It means just what you said, the union of heaven and earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, like, okay, you know, we actually started talking right at the beginning of the show about, you know, why can't we get heaven and earth to meet better? Like, why is there so much mechanical resistance?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't, like, in the future promise of technology, why can't we get our perfect thoughts to meet with matter better? Like, probably the computer does that better than any other machine we've ever possessed, but then when you have a computer breakdown, it's just like... That feeling of mechanical resistance, you know, feels like a punishment almost.
Right.
So then.
Oh my gosh, it does. Jeez.
So then, but since that was my intuition, I wanted to kind of check that with the Oracle, and this is something you can do that Carol Anthony came up with, but I'd also come up with it on my own independently, and that is you can, if you're using three coins, you would just toss the three coins to get an answer of like, am I on the right track? Well, the head side of the coin would be the yang side. That would be like a one or a yes.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did that, of course, I used these glass pebbles, but it was basically three heads.
Mm-hmm.
It was a total confirmation
that
was the question to ask. So the question I propose is, I Ching, please advise us on what we can do as a collective to bring heaven and earth closer together.
Damn straight, Jonathan. What a great question. So how do we get the answer? And let's tell people... a little bit about how we're going to do it, and you decide. I think you should throw the coins. You're the oracle in this case tonight. Maybe just describe a little bit about how you're going to do it. People have to know that we do it six times and build, as you mentioned, the hexagram from the bottom up to build these lines. But I say we just do it.
Definitely. And, yeah, I'm using... glass pebbles that represent, there are four different types representing the four different lines, and they're in a particular ratio. But coins work just as well. Like Carol Anthony went to the I Ching to say, like, should I use the coin method? She got like a hexagram with two changing lines and couldn't make heads or tails. It was like incomprehensible. So then she asked it, should I use the Yarrowstock method? She got the same hexagram and the same two changing lines. So the message seemed to be, but with that oriental oblique sense of humor, like it doesn't matter what method you use, you can deliver the same result.
Right,
so,
right.
And I don't know what to expect. I'm not in control of the Oracle, and it's time for the I Ching to step forward and hopefully...
All right, so people, Jonathan is going to throw his stones, and we'll come up with a hexagram here.
Right.
And then Jonathan, you can read what the message for that particular hexagram is for us, right?
Okay. And usually I ritualize the beginning by doing meditation bells, which would sound awful over the phone, but...
Hey, I've got a short, maybe minute and a half song I can play here.
Okay. Create a little boundary
for us. That way you're not under any pressure or whatever, and you can throw the stones there, and then we'll come back, and you won't have had a whole lot of pressure to do it while we're on the air, okay?
Okay.
All right, we got 2 minutes here, everybody, and Jonathan's going to get us a reading here from the I Ching. And again, the question, John, what are we going to state?
We're asking the I Ching to advise us as a human species, what can we do to bring heaven and earth closer together?
All right, we're going to find out in just a couple minutes. This song is called King Rufus the Fourth. We've got Jonathan Zapp on with us. We're going to read the I Ching in just a minute. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Thank you. King Rufus IV. All right, Charles Shea, thanks for the music, my friend. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Took a short break there to give Jonathan Zapp a couple of minutes to get us a reading from the I Ching. And if you're joining us right now, Jonathan, let's tell him one more time what we posed to this ancient Chinese divination oracle.
Well, it's a pretty gigantic question.
It's a pretty big cookie, man. We're going to take a big chunk out of it here. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically that comes out of that dissatisfaction with the matrix that so many people feel, and I know I do, and how to bring that world of heaven, the world of more ideal forms, the world of the psyche in some ways, in better contact with the world of matter, with the world of the earth. How to bring these together so that we have less mechanical resistance, so we have less of a mechanical world.
So what did you find?
Well, it's just beginning to unfold in my mind. I've only just looked it up, but it seems incredibly interesting. First, I'll tell you what it turns into.
Now, remember, people, there are 64 possibilities when you engage this particular oracle. And they're all very specifically written about and described in many of these different translations. But at any rate, out of the 64 possibilities with regard to the question, how can we bring about a less mechanistic world and a closer union of heaven and earth, essentially, what out of 64 did we get, Jonathan?
Okay. We got hexagram 31, influence. And it turns into number 55, abundance. Very favorable outcome. And the changing lines also seem incredibly interesting. I'm kind of struggling with mechanical resistance here because I'm trying to hold the phone and like open multiple I Ching books at the same time. And it's barely working. I've got the Wilhelm Baines open in front of me. But influence is a huge part of what you're radio show is about. It's about the influence that we have on each other, that this is a time when different people that feel that urgency, that feel that transformation, that feel that urge to bring heaven and earth together in unprecedented ways, create a greater alchemical fire by joining together. Hmm. And it's like you have some motto there, you know, find the others. This relates to influence. The metaphor I use is, you know, if the embers are scattered in the forest, they might go out, but if gathered together, they might create a blaze, the radiance of which is felt in the four corners of the land. So influence is about the influence we have on each other, like the influence that Terrence McKenna has had on both of us, for
my
example.
Gosh, yeah.
Very profound. And but the image of influence is a mountain with a lake on the top. And this is kind of an image of boundaries. The Asian social model is a bit more formal or a bit less naively informal, you might say, than that of most Americans, for example, where there's kind of like this false intimacy, like, you know, people blurt out their secrets on national television shows. So it's kind of like you are open at the top, and there's this joyous and receptive place at the top of the mountain, but there are also kind of steep walls. It's kind of like the inner courtyards that your influence maybe works best with a certain few and not necessarily with every Tom, Dick, and Harry that comes down the street.
Ain't it the truth? That's another Radio Orbit theme. It's not for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. You know, don't cast your pearls before swine. Every spiritual tradition basically says that, you know, the inner and outer courtyards and so forth. But this very general meaning about influence becomes much more specific in the changing lines. And again, I'm kind of trying to juggle all the books here at the moment. But influence is also that image of the lake and the mountain. Is also about an open heart. It's also about there's sort of like an active and a passive side to each hexagram. So one side of influence is like influencing others, but in order to influence others in a non-toxic way, kind of like the Oracle of Delphi, first you need to have been influenced.
Right.
Your openness.
In a healthy manner.
Right, exactly. Your openness, but even that openness needs certain boundaries. You're not just open to any trash that comes across the cultural video monitors and all the different modalities of transmission. You are open to higher influences and to that quiet, still inner voice, within yourself. And by your being allowing yourself to be influenced, then you can influence others. And so this is part of where heaven and earth are being brought together. But the place where most of us have most powerfully experienced heaven and earth coming together would, of course, be in a love relationship, where the natural divide that exists between human beings, our otherness, the fact that we live in separate bodies and have their own separate envelope of skin, despite that all oneness of things, there's also an eachness of things, and there's, we can be like, ships passing in the night of time or with some particular people that we're connected to. Heaven and earth somehow meet, and this mutual influence starts to happen.
Then you can remove those boundaries.
Right, but remove them in just the right cases.
Mm.
And so this is what we need to have happen with the cosmos and with the world of matter. We are opening portals into it, just like in every area of human culture. We're kind of like breaking the code and finding out how DNA works, how matter works in the subatomic plane, and so forth. But I don't want to go off into too many tangents, but bringing this back to the reading, there might be a bit of a warning, and I Ching is often admonishing. Often that's the most helpful thing it does. I'm used to it kind of slapping me upside my head, and after all, we're culture that...
Me too. How often do you get the one that says, to basically stand still, and to not do anything? And I'm the sort of person that has a very difficult time not doing things. And oftentimes the I Ching just slaps me and says, now is the time for stillness.
Absolutely. Well, that just happened in a reading I did a couple hours ago, where I was about to call somebody, and it told me in no uncertain terms, I got turned into mountain over mountain, and it's about keeping still. And that's often what it tells me, because I'm overactive as well. And so that's a classic thing for the I Ching to do. And so the first line talks about the influence shows itself in the big toe. It's kind of an odd metaphor, but it's kind of like that'd be the first part of your body going forward. And so in Wilhelm Baines, it says, a movement before it is actually carried out shows itself in the toes. The idea of an influence is already present, but it is not immediately apparent to others. As long as the intention has no visible effect, it is of no importance to the outside world and leads neither to good nor to evil. So this is something, it's a little bit cryptic there, but in other words, you're right at the beginning of some kind of a cycle or some kind of a change, and we kind of have to catch things before they exit the gate of change. We have to look at what is our intention in establishing an influence before it even happens. So there is the need for a kind of self-awareness needs to enter in if we want heaven and earth to meet. The opposite is to just go about doing things out of pure compulsion energy, kind of like the energy of, Bush, father and son that say, I only look in the mirror. These are like most exact quotes. When I need to shave, I don't psychoanalyze myself. I'm not the guy who reads history, says W. I'm not the guy out there making it. And with what horrifying results, because he's like the big toe rushing out the door without first checking on what's going on before you exiting the gate of change.
Until,
of course, it's all too late.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the first line and is therefore right at the beginning of the process. But then...
Jonathan, there are other people doing this online, by the way, while we're doing it, and there are people throwing their own coins and casting their own yarrow sticks right now. And they're, interestingly, somebody on the web here in the chat room, you got number 31, right?
Yeah.
This guy got number 13. He got the reversal of yours. I'd be interested to see what that is. Maybe a chaos out there. You can tell us what the name of that hexagram is. But anyway, continue, please, John.
Okay. I kind of messed up my pebbles here, so I want to make sure I'm reading the right line here.
And by the way, these lines, the way that they work, when John says changing lines, and the way it works is you get an initial hexagram, and oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, you'll get lines in your hexagram that actually change to the opposite. And what you do is you draw another hexagram, and any of the changing lines that you had in the initial hexagram, you convert those lines to the opposite. If it's a straight line, a single line, you convert it to a dashed line, and vice versa. If you have the broken line, you convert that to an unbroken straight line. And in this way, one hexagram can morph or change into another. And so it does sort of show you. And Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong, but it can sort of give you an idea for where you are and where you may be going.
Yeah, exactly. The most likely meaning for the second hexagram, and thanks for that explanation, which also gave me a chance to get a little undiscombobulated here. The most likely meaning of the second hexagram is this is what the process you're in will tend toward.
Mm.
And this raises an important point that I probably should have said earlier, that the I Ching, at least not the way I use it, is not there to predict the future. It's telling you what's going on in your present process, and the second hexagram may tell you like where the present process you're in is heading toward, but there's room there for free will and for wild card elements to shift that.
Right, that which is apparent if you throw the coins or again consult the oracle, you know, a day or a week later or whatever, you'll come up with something different oftentimes.
Right. So here's something of what the fifth line says from the Wilhelm Baines. And during the next break, I'll look it up in some other I Chings. But this is probably the ruling line of the hexagram. And usually the fifth line is. And it says, what takes place in the depths of one's being, in the unconscious, can neither be called forth nor prevented by the conscious mind. It is true that if we cannot be influenced ourselves, we cannot influence the outside world. Basically, what that says to me as a first take is the way to bring heaven and earth together is kind of like what Darren said, push the art pedal to the metal. That basically means to be true to your own relationship to the muse, which is something that the ego cannot control. It is an influence. It is an influence happening between you and intelligence implicit in the cosmos. What takes place in the depths of one's being in the unconscious can neither be called forth nor prevented by the conscious mind. So that is the channel that opens up and that the ego cannot generate on its own. And if we cannot be influenced ourselves, we cannot influence the outside world. The converse of that is if we can be influenced ourselves, then we can influence the outside world. And that's stated explicitly in the I Ching, elsewhere in the I Ching, where it says the right person thinking the right thoughts affects things thousands of miles away.
Right.
You know, when somebody, just like when we see when somebody makes a discovery, other people often make it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
When you become a channel and you've had a thought or a realization or intuition that hasn't been, others haven't had in that form before, now it becomes part of the human collective mind. And it also becomes part of it may be summoned into reality in the physical world as well. Just like somebody has a thought of a new invention and then pretty soon there it is manufactured. But sometimes it also comes into being without even a mechanical process like manufacture. You have an intuition, or a vision, something, and suddenly there it is happening in the physical world in an incausal way.
Amazing. All right, look, Jonathan, we got to take one more short break here, okay? And we'll come back and we'll wrap things up. But it's been amazing, this discussion about the I Ching. And I've got something that I want to sort of add when we come back from the break. And I think we can close it out sort of nicely, okay?
Excellent.
All right, everybody, Jonathan Zapp, wonderful stuff on the web. Zapp Oracle, ZAPORACLE.com, ZappOracle.com. And it's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit. on the web at MikeHagan, HAGAN.com, and you can always check us out at KOPN as well, on the web at KOPN.org. All right, it's Mike, and back in just a minute with Jonathan Zapp. Let's listen to one more here from Charles Shea. This one is called Slide. Well, let's play Leap of Faith. How about it? All right. It's Leap of Faith, Charles Shea, and it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. Back in a few. All right, everybody, it's Mike. We're back at you here. It's Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, live with Jonathan Zapp from his place in Boulder, Colorado, sticking around with us late into the evening. Jonathan, sorry we had a little bit of a tech problem, but I think I got you back here.
Yes, I hope so.
Yeah, good. Everything's fine. And, okay, well, we got about 20 minutes left, and I've got, I guess, one thing that I have to ask then. We just did this amazing reading with the I Ching, and I thought it was pretty profound, actually. The hexagram that came up, at least the initial one, is one of influence. And one of the things that you talked about was that we as individuals have to be influenced ourselves in order to influence others.
Right. We are kind of the avatars on this planet that stand in the most charged way between heaven and earth. We can be the most earthly and gross and atavistic of creatures. We can also be the most divinely inspired.
Mm.
And a person can you know, live a life of deserved obscurity that you know, where they're just a cog in a machine or a person chanting the same things as a whole, you know, nation or religion are, or a person can be a beacon that changes everybody. The example I use is a Jimi Hendrix. By his being open to the influence of the musical muse, he created electric guitar chords which have never stopped resonating on this planet 30-some-odd years after his death.
Huh.
So when you are, influence has a yin and a yang aspect. By your being receptive, like a mountain with a lake on the top, open to divine influences, now you can be a point where heaven and earth meet if you are an artist or a communicator of some sort or a compassionate person that takes actions that reflect what you've learned from the divine realm and empathic intuitions. And if you then bring it into some kind of form in the material world, you create a painting, you take an action, you speak an insightful sentence to somebody, and now you are standing between those two realms, and heaven and earth are coming to meet in the best way that we've always been able to do. And with it turning into abundance, it may be showing that you know, be careful what you summon into being. That's the meaning of the first line, you know, before you rush out the door. Careful how you're bringing heaven and earth together, because that's not necessarily a sentimental union. Somebody can be bringing a very toxic idea into all too potent existence. But you can reach that point of by being open yourself to creating influences toward others that may make this a better world.
Right, and I think it's important to reiterate that, as you mentioned, there's also sort of a warning there as well, that there are so many things being slung at you that you have to be careful what you do accept, and you have to be discerning. You have to be open, but at the same time you cannot accept everything.
Right, and this actually brings up a very important point about oracles, which is that part of their purpose is to deliver subtle shocks, just like it's the purpose of dreams, especially nightmares, to deliver subtle shocks. Now, those shocks can sometimes seem not so subtle in the case of a shocking nightmare or something, but the unsubtle shocks that happen are like the tragic occurrences, or the, you know, might take the form of a war, a disease, you know, who knows what. But only the conscious person, which is what the I Ching assumes about you, it calls it the superior man or superior person, the conscious person, is capable of changing based on a subtle shock. The person who's conscious of their body notices a little symptom and they make an adjustment in their diet. The unconscious person waits until it's a disease. And I'm not saying that conscious people don't have diseases too, but you follow the metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that warning to us is like a subtle shock, and we may be able to learn from it, but the unfortunate thing about the collective is that consciousness is more the purview of the individual, and the collective tends toward a lowest common denominator, and therefore the collective often only learns through gigantic shocks, you know, cataclysmic upheavals, wars, huge collective tragedies, and so forth. And so we are a species that has so much power, and a lot of that power is being more distributed now with the technologies we have.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be careful before we reach out to make heaven and earth come together, what idea or vision we are trying to bring into reality.
Okay. Jonathan, shamanism, is this oracle? In other words, we know now that shamans, both men and women, when I say shamans, I mean both of our genders, drumming, dancing, ordeal, breath control, consumption of psychoactive plants or mushrooms, is this a way to access the similar realm of information?
I think so. And it has a great advantage over human shamans and human gurus. They have their own advantages as well, but one advantage the I Ching has is it has no ego. and therefore it won't hit on you. It won't ask you to turn over your bank account and all those things that human gurus and sometimes even shamans, mostly they're about healing, but in any field there are the charlatans and the people who are maybe even more dangerous, the sort of half charlatan, half visionary types. But the I Ching has no ego. It has no selfish or egocentric agenda. And it also has a tremendous convenience in that it's available to you 24 hours a day at very little expense, just for the trouble of buying some books and, you know, the few minutes it really takes to learn how to build a hexagram.
Right, learn the technique. Right.
And you have access to it at any time and don't have to travel to some faraway land, don't have to take something that might make you feel nauseous. And, you know, it's right there.
Fascinating. Okay. All right. That's it, you guys. How about it? The I Ching. That was a great exposition of how that thing works, Jonathan. Thanks so much for doing that.
Oh, you're quite welcome, and thank you to the I Ching for joining us.
How about it? Yeah, it's a strange marriage when you start to get to know this thing. Maybe we can talk just a bit more about it before I ask you some other questions. But what about the King Wen sequence?
Well, the King Wen sequence, which for the listeners that may not know, is a traditional ordering of the hexagrams, but that's not totally mathematically obvious why they're in that order.
Right. But they seem to come up in a particular order.
Right, and of course the thing that both of us are probably wondering about is the relationship of that King Wen sequence in Terence McKenna. Terence, I guess when he was down in the Amazon with his brother Dennis and had taken some mushrooms, heard a voice that asked him the question, what is the meaning of the King Wen sequence of the I Ching?
I Ching, right.
And so that was the call to adventure for him, you know, the opening into the rabbit hole, and he came up with an idea that this was a fractal time wave, that the King Wen sequence was showing a basic pattern of two great variables that he called habit and novelty. And the thing that I think Terence for sure was right about was that the I Ching recognized that time is not an even topography.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows we have days when, like, you might have three synchronistic weird things happen before breakfast and other days that are much more mundane.
Right, right.
And that happens collectively as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure,
so there are
sure,
these zones
sure.
and seasons of time. And the I Ching definitely recognizes that. But Terence added an additional piece. He felt that he had a specific formula to map it.
Right.
In smaller or greater timescales.
You know, I don't know if you were listening earlier in the program, but I'm going to talk to John Sheliak.
Right.
I don't bow to anything, you know what I mean? Terence was brilliant, and I loved him as a person, and just as a great heart. You know what I mean? I mean, just his heart and his ideas of what we could do as individuals, just to, you know, to be better people and to make a better world. Alone, we're worth, as you say, you know, gold pressed latinum. But the time wave was an attempt, you know, to move into a scientific description of what was happening and to use, you know, the scientific world to describe it, mathematics, etc. And for, you know, as good as it was, John Sheliak is just outrageous when it came down to it. He was the coolest, you know?
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding of what went on, and it was with the specific predictions of Time Wave 2000 that I always felt that Terence, who I consider such a great visionary genius, that was kind of caught in the grips of his own obsession. That was kind of like his bete noire, or,
right,
you know,
right,
Dick or something.
And I think he even realized it, you know, but there was like almost nothing he could do about it.
Right, right. I mean, and I spoke to, had the privilege to, you know, speak to him about it a little bit in 1996, and he basically admitted, I was kind of giving him a hard time, which is my way of, you know,
mm-hmm,
showing unconditional
mm-hmm
love
mm-hmm
as the aggressive Socratic dialogue, and that was fine for him. He's a
sure
double Scorpio or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I...
He loved it. He loved a good questioning, a good
right
challenge. Yeah.
So I was kind of pointing out the fudge factor of how he would locate novelty, you know, sometimes like at the birth of a figure because that was convenient to the graph, at other times only when the, you know, the historic figure like Muhammad had created something astounding that started to change things.
Right, after he began to write, yes.
And he basically said, yeah, you know, novelty is a slippery concept. And, but, and then...
You know, Rupert,
Rupert
Sheldrake said, and Rupert, you know, who was very close with Terence, you know, he said, well, you know, the time wave sort of required Terence's personality to interpret it.
Right, right, exactly. And Rupert and the chaos mathematician, I can't think of his name.
Oh, Ralph Abraham.
Right, exactly. Yeah. They would often give him some ribbing on that score in the trilogues and elsewhere, I guess. And it was Ralph Abraham who you know, asked him to make it more mathematically accessible. And then there was a big challenge to it that came from a guy.
Watkins, I think the guy's name was, or
yeah, something like that. He was a retro psychokinesiologist. He was a person who was also trying to move objects like psychokinetically in the past. There was even a particular name for that, and like Terence was just like, "Who are you? What are you?" But apparently, his mathematical challenge was enough that Terence, with his, you know, largeness of character, you know, had to admit that there were flaws there.
Right.
And I guess the guy that you're talking about is the guy who came in with the fix, and then Time Wave 2000 was sort of reissued.
Right, yeah, yeah. Shelley basically said, well, yeah, you did make a mistake here, and you did make a mistake here, but we can correct for that, and you're still, and in fact, you now have a workable theory still, basically.
Right. And I wonder if the new wave works better. When I met Terence and I asked him those questions in 1996, it was like the moment of I think, disconfirmation of Time Wave 2000, because the original version of it predicted this immense descent into novelty in the first 3 months of 1996.
96, yeah, that's
and
right.
Terence was on this tour.
Right.
And I don't think he had that much to show for it. We had that the brightest comet in several hundred years, but there wasn't really, you know, a discovery here or there. He like read off a list of possible things, and they were pretty unimpressive. And so it was like a time of disconfirmation, and that's basically been the history of any time you've tried to timescale anything. It never seems to work. And also, what I think almost everybody fails to take into account is the trickster aspect of the unconscious.
Boy, yeah.
Synchronicities can be generated by psychic intentions and take you down a distorting rabbit hole, you know, where you think you've seen something and you've been you've been encountering intelligence, but it's oblique and intelligence with a sense of humor, and that teaches you by misdirection and by playing little tricks too.
Yeah, that's the way the universe sometimes smacks you in secret ways, you know.
Right. It confounds your reasonable expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Your ability and
no one's immune. It's the best of us, the worst of us, all of us in between. It's just the way it works.
Oh, absolutely. I've been caught by the trickster aspect of synchronicity more times than I care to remember.
I have myself. All right, quickly, 2012.
Well, I was funny. I was just talking, I guess it was the day before yesterday, I spent a few hours with John Major Jenkins, who's been on your show a couple
of
times.
Sure, I love John. He's wonderful. He just happened, go ahead.
I think he's really the best qualified person to talk about 2012 by far. I mean, he's really the one that recreated the ancient Mayan cosmology. He and Terence both about the same time discovered that it was associated with a galactic alignment.
Mm-hmm.
I actually met John through Terence and met them both at the same time. And we were talking about and had anticipated this for years, the New Age carnival that would start to get built up around it, and how it would be turned into people would take their whole Judeo-Christian background that, of course, they feel they're completely beyond, and there are some big names involved in this, and project that apocalypticism onto that date, and start counting down to it and bind themselves even more into linear time. And it's like John has a saying that I like a lot. I wish he'd write a book with this title. The 2012 is the center of time, not the end of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the galactic alignment thing that it seems to sync up with now, and also John does not necessarily believe that something incredibly dramatic will happen on December 21st, 2012. Terence did. He had a completely different view.
Mm-hmm.
He saw novelty exponentiating.
Right, and then just going into complete omega point, where everything just occurs at the same
right.
time. Right. Yeah.
Whereas John Jenkins' view is that the galactic alignment is a bit more gradual than that. It might be like a 30-year process. We're basically in that zone right now because the universe has sort of fractal boundaries or, you know, not precisely symmetrical boundaries. So it is an estimated thing. The minds came very close.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically in that zone right now. And I think what John also points out in his book, Galactic Alignment, is that other cultures recognize that process of alignment, and it's very significant, and they assigned the same meaning to it, basically, sometimes called the perennial philosophy. The Western alchemists recognized it, the Hindus, the Egyptians apparently, that there'd be a cycle of four great ages within that approximately 26,000-year galactic alignment cycle, and that these ages, which would be associated with metals, gold, silver, bronze, and iron,
right.
That there would be this process of densification. You would start out in a golden age with the maximum amount of spiritual light, heaven and earth coming together the strongest. And then by the iron age, which in the Hindu model is called, the ages are called yugas, would be the Kali Yuga.
Mm-hmm.
The age we're in right now is when they would be the furthest apart. But we're actually at the cusp. We're at the cusp of the end of the Kali Yuga, the end of the darkest age, the Iron Age, and the beginning of a new golden age.
Amazing.
And we actually see evidence of that everywhere. Like, we're in the age of fundamentalist materialism, the most unspiritual of worldviews, but the very thing that it's associated with, technology, is etherealizing and becoming more and more about light right before our eyes. So, for example, in the 1990s, calculated that the value of the U.S. industrial production increased in value by like three times, but its physical weight diminished by more than half,
mm-hmm.
because we were making less pig iron, less iron locomotives
right.
and that kind of thing, and more like pixels and
right.
more like intellectual property in the form of zeros and ones.
Mm-hmm.
Technology, you know, our very materialism is in itself etherealizing, and I think we're seeing things that would support that idea that we're on the cusp of a movement toward a process of enlightening in every sense of that word.
Well, all right, Jonathan, I wish we could keep it up, but we have reached the end of our time again so quickly, but amazing stuff as usual. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Man, incredible. And we'll just keep our eyes on it. We'll do it again. I'll get in touch with you, you know, whenever, and we'll get back on the air and just keep our eyes on things. There's not much else we can do other than participate with our hearts and, like you mentioned earlier in the program, just do our thing and
be open to influence.
Be open to influence. So, all right, amazing stuff, and you're creating a great influence yourself, Jonathan. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. You as well.
All right, take care. I'll talk
take
to you
care.
Soon. Bye. Everybody, Jonathan Zapp, and we'll be hearing from John again soon. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Come on back next week, same time, 11 p.m. on Monday, as always. And we'll have John J. Harper next week. I'm not sure what we'll do for music, but it'll be cool. I got a bunch of great stuff that I've come across in the last couple days, a couple weeks, I guess I should say. But good music and good fun again next week. Stick around. We got Ruth coming on the air here. She's going to play some good music for you. And we'll catch up with you next week. Okay, one more here from Charles Shay. This one is called Space Jammin'. I'll catch you later. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit.